Richard, I want to go back a little bit over here and talk a little bit more about you know, Caesar's spirituality and his compassion and ability to connect with people. Can you talk a little bit about this, you know, this ability to talk to even the poorest, the most humble, as well as be able to talk to, you know, to the powerful? What was that ability to connect on one to one? What did you see there?
Well, I think I want to begin back with that, how he was in touch with himself to begin with, that center that he developed and maintained, and with a great deal of discipline as well, was so much so that there were times when if you saw him in his living room doing his yoga, he looked like the people you saw in the books. He just would transform almost literally and look like the people you saw in the books, because he would execute them so perfectly well. And it evolved because he wasn't that great in the beginning. I remember when he began, you know, with his yoga books and began doing it, and then saw him years later, and my goodness, he was so accomplished that he had just great control of himself and the breathing and everything else that goes with good yoga. And so he carried that out to his relationship with people, because he was still in a great deal of serenity no matter what the situation or the pressures. And so he carried that out with people, but the humility that came both from his parents, who were very humble people, and he was very close to and really cared a lot for and emulated, I think, in many ways. But he would carry that out so that, excuse me, a few years after he passed, I ran into Dolores Huerta about 2 in the morning at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, and we just happened to be going different places and met there in the middle of the night. And Dolores said, you know, I've been meaning to get a hold of you because I had a dream about you and Caesar. And my dream was that you were there at an event. He was talking to farm workers, and you were telling him, Caesar, we have to go. We have to catch a plane, which was often the scene, the real scene back in our time. And said, and he wouldn't go. And you were telling him, Caesar, we got to go. He said, Richard, you have to write about that sometime, because it was really interesting how that happened. But we knew it was almost a routine. It was an unstated routine that he wasn't going to leave an event, no matter where we had to go or what the urgency was to catch a plane to go somewhere, until the last person had gotten from him what they wanted, whether it was just a hello, a little talk, a little advice, a little counseling. And so it didn't matter who it was or how poor they were, he would give them that kind of respect. And so it was a big part of his makeup, was respecting the dignity of others and trying to, when he'd speak about it, not publicly, but every once in a while privately, can he'd say, it's about, you know, we have to, the greatest teaching we have to offer each other is to teach people how to be people. So there's not enough of that. We don't learn how to treat other people. And so he applied it, talked about it very little, but applied it very often.
Right. Okay. Now, one of the things that struck me in talking to a number of people over the years was the particular bond that he had with the Filipino workers, the men, and I remember people ask over. Tell us a story about, you know, basically how they become brothers. What was that bond there?
Well, let me. Are you at least in part referring to Pete's interview in one of those films, Fight in the Fields?
Well, yeah, that was a film that Rick and I did. Yeah, and I just remember that wonderful conversation with how they met, but also there was a sense of brotherhood there that was not. I hadn't heard from anyone else in the same way.
Well, I asked you the question because when I look back at that, and I wasn't a part of it, but I watched it and I knew who was authentic and who wasn't in it, by the way. And the person who was the most authentic and the best to me was Pete Velasco.
Yeah. But there was a bond there.
No, I say that because not only was there a bond there, but Pete was probably of the well-known Filipino leaders in the movement. Pete was probably the least renowned, but within the movement, he was the most accomplished. he did more of the hard work than anyone, and he did it at an advanced age. And he would go, he went on the boycott. I remember him in Baltimore, and, you know, we used to call him Mr. Money because he was Secretary Treasurer. But Mr. Money, who was always about raising money with buttons or whatever it is, brother, and, you know, he did a lot of stuff. But Pete was the most authentic and the longest lasting and the least renowned, but the one who did the most from any, for any individual Filipino in the history of the movement. Pete was the one who contributed the most, even though he's never been known for that. But that, be that as it may, when you go back to the beginning, I mean, you know, I mentioned how Caesar's affection and fondness for the for the Filipinos, especially the Manong, is that he often would depict their history as the saddest chapter of California's history and would describe in great detail what happened to them and what they went through and had to suffer through just to be here as young men, only young men, from the Philippines to do this work and how they'd become the best at what they did and, you know, what they had to do for recreation, what they had to do for to be with women, what they and how they ended up, those few who married at a certain age, married Mexicans because you could get away with it with married Mexicans because they had the laws that wouldn't allow them to marry. But he always respected that history and their abilities and demonstrated it in so many ways. And how he, in a special way, took care of and catered to them, including the village, but throughout the strikes, there were some very loyal older Filipinos. Unfortunately, with very few exceptions, a handful of exceptions, that wasn't able to transfer to the younger Filipinos who were farm workers at the time. I don't know exactly why, but I remember seeing it, noting it, and living through it. But his love for them and their being part of not only his movement and extended family, but a part of his immediate family, and taking care of our children and loving it and cooking for us, and Helen's special relationship to the Filipino brothers.
What was it about the Filipino brothers, about the older men in particular, that create that? What was that bond with Caesar and Pete and some of the older brothers?
I you know, from my first days with the Farm Workers Union, when I met Benson and Catarino and Willie Barrientos and those guys in Coachella on the picket lines, they were people who would do anything for the movement. And just the way Pete depicted it to you, that's the way they lived their lives. And that's how much they were part of the union and followers of Caesar at the time. Then I, you know, as I moved on and learned and met and spent a lot of time with Larry Itliong and Philip Veracruz and others, Andy Imutan, those. But I also worked with, some of these wonderful people who worked in the offices. I'm trying to think of Hagen, really nice guy that did the, used to send out Caesar's mailings and stuff with the old plates that you'd stamp the address. But Sahagin and the guy that ran the, it wasn't even a printing press, but it was a duplicating machine there. Usually I remember all their names, but Fred Abad. And there were these beautiful people who did everything and anything they were asked to do on picket lines and tried to do stuff. But there was often in the Filipino crews in agriculture and farm worker, in the grapes especially, they were led by a crew boss. And they had to do with that. Whatever the relationships were, whatever they had over them, they were very much controlled more than other workers, even in the 70s. So it was harder to get that group to come out on strike because they had the allegiance to that boss who had the relationship with the employers. So that was very tough. But throughout all that, Caesar just had a feeling that he owed and the society owed these Filipino men especially something for all they had suffered, and that was beyond their contributions to the American Armed Forces and World War II and all of that. But he's just talking specifically about agriculture and how they contributed, and yet they were, you know, forced to live just as young single men in camps and grow up that way and grow old that way with nobody caring or looking out for them. So I think he made that a special role for himself. He carved it out that he had to do special stuff, and they knew that. And I think that no matter what other differences ever happened with Larry or Philip, who, again, people I knew, got along with very well, you know, loved and admired, but they didn't do the things some of the other people I mentioned did. They were outward spokespeople to community groups, to the Bay Area groups. But when it came to farm workers and the boycott and the hard work, nobody beat Pete Velasco for doing things that were probably above his ability to do. And he did it with the best effort he could always put out. But those others who lived in the village later just were people who were great examples of a sad chapter of U.S. history, California history. And Caesar did his most to try to make up for some of that, and just made sure that, I mean, it was a real familial relationship, and that when we got married in Delano, and our reception was at the Filipino Hall, the Helen worked with the Filipino brothers to cook the chicken, so we had adobo and other things there for our wedding, but they were all invited because they were part of the Chavez family. And so it was a very direct, close relationship. And I think Helen fostered it a lot, but so did the children. And there was just, it was always something very special. And they, because they didn't, most of them didn't have children of their own, they took special pride in caring for our children or carrying them or doing just simple things they never got a chance to do in their own lives. And I think Caesar shared that lesson with some of us, and we bought into it as well in a real way.
Now, Richard, you traveled with Caesar for a number of years to all over the country, all over the world, actually, and there were always many, many people wanting to hear of Caesar's philosophy, church groups, etc. You know, he was in demand, but can you give us an idea of, like, you know, were you speaking to small groups? Were you speaking to crowds? I mean, can you give us an idea of the magnitude of sometimes that you would encounter of the people that, you know, the crowds that Caesar was speaking to? Was it dozens of people, thousands of people? Give us a sense of that.
Try to create a little perspective here. In the 3.5 years from early 72 to the end of 75 that I traveled with him, an average year, we'd probably spend about 100 days with farm workers. I'd say 125 days with farm workers, 125 days on these trips you're referring to. And, you know, another 100 days or so in La Paz. And in all of that, in the 100 days in the outside of rural areas, in the cities, they would always involve being in various cities in California, Arizona, Florida, New York, New Jersey, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois. You name the state, we were there. You name the university or the college, we were there. And whenever he'd go to any of those cities, he never liked to have, we didn't have free time to go see the sights. We didn't go to the ball games. We didn't go to the movies because he would ask them to fill up his schedule as much as they could. So they would oftentimes start the schedule in those 125 days a year with a 7 a.m. breakfast. So let's say church leaders or labor leaders. An average day would be, 150, 200 people at a breakfast, 7 o'clock. And then you'd have radio and TV shows throughout the day. Maybe a lunch event or a couple of lectures at schools with anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 students. Average crowds were at universities were often 1,000 or more, wherever this was in the country. And then you'd have a lot of days, maybe 15, 20 times a year to speak to union conventions in the U.S. or Canada, and those were always several thousand delegates. You'd have a lot of churches and church groups, sometimes as few as, depending on the small, you know, town in Florida or a city in Michigan or a union hall in southern Ohio, there'd always be minimum crowds, average, 100, 150 people at an event that he would speak at, no matter where it was. And they'd always be, you know, the interviews in the car while we were driving, radio interviews, press interviews, always trying to spread the message of the movement. And we'd go even on the wacko, before they were popular, right-wing talk shows, you know, to 11 o'clock midnight. We'd do that circuit anywhere in the country as well. And then there'd be the occasional New York or Philadelphia talk show when the one guy was, I can't remember, he just died recently in this year of 2007. One of the people that was one of the early talk show people but out of Philadelphia. But so there were large crowds, oftentimes 1,000 people, 800 was an average size. Then it was a smaller group, so it was 150, 200, whether it was labor or churches. Student crowds were often the biggest. And we did this year in and year out, went to all the schools in Canada. You know, church events were often very large as well, sometimes, you know, in the several hundreds. But there were thousands and thousands of people who he would give the exact same message to every time. He'd stay on message because he understood there wasn't the power of TV or CNN or the internet. You had to talk to every group, and every time you talked was not giving the same talk. It was giving this talk to that group for the first time.
What was it? How is it that this very humble person, this man, could connect with thousands of people like that? How was that possible?
As in his own words, he used to say. In a lot of these talks, when asked a similar question, he would say that he believes the American people are like to root for the underdog. And so he based it on that. I think, going back to that, he knew in the beginning he had nothing to lose by keeping his authenticity or honesty about what he was talking about, keeping his message very simple. He would connect with people because they could understand it. And I remember on that one show, I'm trying to remember the name of the host, Mike Douglas. Mike Douglas show. He was there in the Mike Douglas show in about 1974 because Anthony Quinn was a co-host that week. And when he had a co-host then, the co-host could pick the guests that they were going to have that week. And Anthony Quinn said he wanted to meet Cesar Chavez. And so that's when they met, and they later became, you know, good friends. But as far as friends who were outside of the movement could be, but Anthony was a supporter as well. But when we were on the Mike Douglas show, at that time, a not-so-famous Loretta Lynn was on the show as well, with the guy who'd become famous on the movie with her a few years later. Doolittle was there too, and I was with Doolittle in the back in the green room. And Loretta served it up when she... You know, she got excited about what Cesar was doing, and she said, "Well, I want to know what's wrong with the lettuce." And Cesar told Loretta what was wrong with the lettuce, and I understand it now. So he was very good at even making complex associations simple so that people who asked the right question could get it. So Loretta got it that night, and she kind of liked him. And, you know, I think it was, it might have been the same show that Duke Snyder and the boxer Rocky Graciano was on as well. And Rocky Graciano saw Cesar and said, "Hey, you know, I see you around the country. You're a good fighter. You're a tough guy. I like you because you believe in fights." So there was that combination of being genuine and knowing the American people liked underdogs, and being that underdog and not being afraid to say he's fighting. And so it'd always be presented in the right light. 9 times out of 10, it'd be presented in the right light. So he'd get his message out very clearly, very simply and be able to appeal to whoever the audience was, large audience, small audience, TV audience. And he was very adept at media interviews because he came across as who he was, and his humility was always out front when he spoke on those. He never spoken, you know, it's great that I'm a famous guy and I'm on your show. He spoke the same way there that would get the message out that would get him and the movement more support.
Okay. Now, Rich, I think we're going to have to wrap this up pretty soon, but I just want to talk a little bit about your observations, the feelings that and the recollections you had at Caesar's funeral at his passing. There was Caesar always said that, you know, when his children would ask, well, when are we going to do this and when are we going to do that, and Caesar would say, you know, when the eagle flies. And apparently there was a very touching moment during his funeral, if you will recollect, about when the eagle did fly. Could you tell that story a little bit?
Yeah, and it's in a funny way. I'd preface it by saying, in a way, I hesitate to tell some of the stories because it's and people start to think that I was a freak, but I'm very pleased to tell them. And that is it. Upon Caesar's sudden and unexpected death, there were any number. I'll just give you a few of them, but there were any number of really remarkable, simple occurrences. A lot of them to do with Native American symbols. And, you know, and to begin with, I remember telling my brother-in-law Fernando the night we got together, the first night of his passing. I remember telling Fernando, I said, damn, I said, you know, it's interesting or funny or odd that he's the first ever Mexican-American Indian chief to die, you know, Mexican-American Catholic Indian chief. And we were kidding because farm workers often called him El Indio. They often called him El Jefe, the chief. So, and people in English would call him the chief. So we didn't think that literally until after his passing. And I think you look back at the last day of his life. I interviewed or spoke with Marco, who's the attorney there at La Paz, Marcos. Yeah, Marcos Camacho, an attorney, young attorney with the farm workers, who was with him his last day. Can I ask Marcos, tell me about the day that you had with him there? And he was back home in Yuma, Arizona, you know, his hometown, where he was at very seldom, and where about 12 years before, he had had a near-death experience in a plane, a crash landing there in the same place. In his birthplace. So it was always interesting to know that he had gone full circle in his life. And Marco said that day he had got through testifying in court there in Yuma. And he said, Marcos, I'd like to go for a drive around town. And they took a drive and they went by, and he was pointing out things. That's a church I was baptized in. He went to a store. That's a store my uncle owned. That's where my father had his pool hall. And then they went and stopped at a store that had Native American merchandise. And in the store, he bought one thing. He bought a book with a lot of Native American symbols. And he bought the book, Native American symbols. And as they were leaving, he told Marcos, he said, you know, Native Americans have it very tough in this country. We should use our network to help them get a better price for their goods and help them sell their goods. So that was that. And that evening was the last time anyone saw him alive. But the next morning when he was found in his bed, you know, dying, you know, the peaceful death of a saint, he had on his chest, he still had his glasses on, he was still, you know, in his reading form. He read every night, as I said before, his whole life. But on his chest was that book that he had bought the day before. And the page it was on was a page full of various colorful Indian eagles on the page of the book, that is the last book he was reading. And so thus began a number of occurrences over the days leading to his burial and beyond. So that was one, was that little symbol there. Then the day he died and the announcement got out, going through our shock that morning and not believing it was even possible, but being in our state of shock and gathering up our family and leaving on the drive to La Paz, I remember being struck by hearing, by the time we got to L.A., hearing the radio saying that that kept saying that he had died in Yuma. And I had understood the call from my wife, who called her mother, who was there when her brother told him. I, for several hours, understood it to be that he died in bed at home. And then I kept hearing the radio as we're driving saying he died in Yuma. And I said, I asked my wife, why do they keep saying he died in Yuma? And she finally explained to me, because he did. My brother came to tell my mother that he had gotten a call, not that he had died there at home. So I got it. And so, and then I started realizing immediately, wow, he went full circle. That's an amazing part of life. Very Native American, went full circle in his life. Then we get to, at the same time occurring there, is one of his dearest friends, Bill Soltero, who was a former head of the laborers union in Arizona, had gone to the scene. And Bill, who's from a native of Arizona like Caesar, didn't trust Yuma County officials to touch him, so Bill got a plane, chartered a plane to bring his body to Bakersfield immediately without anything. He said, I don't want anybody in Arizona touching him, so he sent him to Bakersfield. On the other end, as we're driving, we get a call in the car, and somebody asked, do you know the coroner in Bakersfield? And I had done a lot of work in Kern County, and the coroner was a good friend of mine. And I called and said, you know, can you ask her if she can stay open late, because the body won't be there till a certain hour. So we did get, managed to get her to say she'd hold open and be there. And then we got to La Paz, and we took a drive. I knew this African-American friend of mine who knew Caesar, who had a part-time job as a mortician. And I called him. He was in L.A. working for the House of Winston, which is the biggest African-American funeral home in L.A. And I called Irving Nichols, and I said, Irving, can you come recommend somewhere in Bakersfield where we can take him to when his body gets there? And he called me back a while later, said, take him to Anderson Mortuary. We'll be there to pick him up. So we always had a family joke that Caesar was very dark-skinned, and so it was appropriate that he was going to be taken to an African-American mortuary to be worked on by an African-American mortician. And we, later, some Latino morticians were mad. Mortuaries were mad that we didn't go to them. But it was appropriate that he went to where he went. But anyway, we took a group down to meet his body at the airport. And I think Artie Rodriguez and David Martinez were with them. But as we left La Paz, a bunch of us in a couple of cars, I asked Helen to, did she have a farm worker flag, an eagle flag? And so she did, and we brought it. And as soon as we picked up his body, we had the flag put in his, you know, the belt that was holding him onto the gurney. And from that moment on, he had from the rest of his time before he was buried, he had an honor guard 24 hours a day that involved eventually some 500-600 people. But that day, we got the announcement that he died. During that day, unbeknown to us at the time, till a few days later, that the 40 Acres, an unnamed group of Native Americans from somewhere in the valley, showed up at the 40 Acres, and they told, my understanding was they told, what's the lady's name there? You know, really, the oldest staff member. I'm trying to think. Nana's friend. Esther Urandi, coming back here. So Esther Urandi, who was the manager of the 40 Acres at the time, this group visited with her, and they said, we heard about the, you know, Cesar Chavez passing. We want to come here and consecrate some land here. And they went and did some kind of a ceremonial dance there at the 40 Acres. And so that was another part of the Native American symbolism. And they gave her an ear of corn, and they said, this is food for his journey. They gave it to her. So that was there. Then Irving got to town, and he ended up doing the best, embalming job I've ever seen in my life, and anybody who was there ever saw, because it's so good that a week later, Caesar didn't appear like most people do. He appeared to be someone who was asleep, and you wanted to wait. Okay, quit kidding now. Get up. Is he looked that good? And Irving did a marvelous job. And so it was Friday. By Saturday morning, I think is when I got asked to be the coordinator of the services, and thus began a real tense, emotional, tumultuous week of planning and debating and a lot of things that went on to get this service ready. But back to the Native American and back to the initial question, things began to happen like the, you know, with Helen, Helen finding that card with the colorful birds on the card. Then the night, so he was there. Irving came and had taken him to Bakersfield. He was in Bakersfield. He brought him back up on Sunday, brought his body up. And Irving, we were going to get a bite to eat when Helen started to cook. And Irving said to me, he said, Richard, I like Caesar. I love Caesar, and we're good friends. But you've never seen my work. How did you know I was going to do a good job? I said, because, Irving, you knew Caesar. You were a farm worker. I just knew. But I didn't know he was going to do the excellent work he did. And so Irving really did a marvelous job. And Richard Chavez, you know, Caesar had asked him years before that he wanted him to build a coffin, and he wanted a simple wooden coffin like his friend New York, the woman, Bowery District, Dorothy Day, like his friend Dorothy Day was buried in. Dorothy was in a very simple wood coffin. Well, Richard answered the request, but Richard, his brother, is a master carpenter. So he built a marvelous-looking box for his brother. It was very beautiful. It was a work of art. And he built that for his brother. And when Caesar was, by about Wednesday, I think we're going to take him to Delano, to lie in state in Delano for a couple of days. And when he was going to go, his body was going to go in the car, there was a thing where down by the creek in La Paz, as he was going by, the frogs that he used to often go down and listen to croaked louder than you could imagine. They croaked so that you could hear it. It was just a very eerie situation, but natural for what was going on where we were. You got to the long story short, we got to the final day there when Caesar was to be buried. And that morning, I remember, and I don't have it here, but I had, at 5 o'clock that morning, I sort of wrote a poem capturing Caesar's life. And part of it was just about, the corn and the concha horn and, you know, a Gandhian way of life and, you know, how I once saw him lay down in St. Francis' bed in Assisi, and I said I saw him cry that day, and he was very moved to be there. But I read the poem that morning to Jose Montoya, who's a renowned Chicano poet and artist, and Jose said, well, you know, I never heard you do this, but he said, you hit a classic here, but part of the, I said, well, you got to help me interpret what I wrote. He said, well, part of it is you have to have a young girl put the corn in his coffin with him. And so that was that morning. I need to go back a step to the evening to really capture the eagle part. The other eagle was when we had about 5,000-6,000 people at the Rosary on Wednesday night. Wednesday night. There was a lot of good pandemonium of people and emotion and energy, and you can always work with that because people are at their best even if it's confusing and chaotic at times. And so after a little bit of, I had sort of had the ball taken out of my hands by that time, so I let the things flow, and there was a log jam, and someone said, well, you know, you got to help us get rid of this log jam. Everybody stood up and walked in every direction at the same time, which means nobody moved. And I was a little bit bothered, and I said, "No, you guys didn't let me finish. You guys took over. I would have practiced this 50 times before tonight. You figure it out." And that went on for a few minutes, and finally I said, "Okay." And I got Jose Montoya and these other great artists from Sacramento, the Royal Chicano Air Force, who were great friends of Caesar, and they're great followers and helpers and supporters, who he really liked to hang out with because they were artists and they were funny and they were interesting and they were crazy, and they loved him. And so it was appropriate that they were there, and I asked them to help set the tone there, how we're going to have people move through. And we had set up the situation there knowing that there are going to be a lot of emotional Mexicans there, and if they were allowed to, they would jump in the box with him. So we didn't want to have that. So we set it just far enough and appropriate enough with flowers and plants so you could see him well and fairly close, but you couldn't jump in. And people were moving this way, sort of right to left, and he was laying there, and moving right to left in front of me. And we developed some language quickly and a flow, because you had thousands of people wanted to come by and see this guy. And we were just asking people, we came up with the words, you know, adelante, por favor, you know, both go forward and sort of fast, but please, and don't stop, keep on going, don't stop to do pictures or whatever else. And in the middle of that, it was going very well, in the middle of that, one gentleman didn't ask for our permission, and we didn't stop him. Kenny stopped, and from his coat he pulls out a large feather, and he turns and he does the blessing to the north and the south and the east and the west, and he turns and reaches in, puts in Caesar's hand, he says, "The eagle's feather," and he put it in Caesar's hand. And at that moment, I kind of, you know, you go through a lot of emotions, but it was kind of a good humor emotion at the time. I went back to tell my wife and others in the family. They said, "You know that story about, you know, when the eagle flies? He was the eagle, and he just flew because the guy just gave him his wing." And so that was a part of it. And to continue to the next morning is when we had the final viewing with Cardinal Mahoney there and a bunch of people from the Kennedy family and just all of Caesar's family and extended family and others close to him, his board of directors and others. And we were in that same place that I mentioned before, this almost 10 feet away from the spot I first saw him 23 years before, the first day I saw him in that January 1970, literally, you know, 10 feet away from the exact spot. And the place had been changed a little bit, but it was the same spot in the room. And before the coffin was closed and the Cardinal was making the final blessing, we had our youngest daughter, Cynthia, who my brother-in-law, Fernando, always called her Papoose. So she was chosen to be the one to go put the corn in her grandfather's hands for food for his journey. So that was put in his hands. She went and found the spot and put it in there. And it was closed. And then I remember going to the where the procession was going to begin at Memorial Park, several miles away, 3 miles away, a march we had done many, many times when Caesar was alive during strikes. And on the way there, the two things that blew my mind is, well, that we also asked Irving, who got in trouble at one point because he took off in the car from the House of Winston in L.A. and just drove up to Bakersfield to take care of Caesar. And I had to call the owner to get him sort of off the hook at one point. But I asked him, someone asked us, you know, we're going to put him in a truck. What are we going to do? And it took a lot of guidance from Irving. And Irving would say, well, in these matters, it's God, the family, and everybody else is how you do these things. And so I asked Irving, what do you think, Irving? Should we have cars? Hey, House of Winston, I can get you all the cars you want, you know, the greenish, dark green Cadillacs. And I thought, no, Cadillac Caesar, no, they're not going to change him at this time. It's not going to spoil his image. So, and then I asked Artie Rodriguez, Artie, what's a good number for Caesar? And he said 9 because there were 9 members of the first board of directors. I said, good, Irving, get us 9 cars. So we had 9 cars for the family to go in. And when we were driving over to the head of the procession, I remember noting two things in the long procession that was there and the thousands of people. There were so many young people and so many obvious Native Americans from different walks of life, which was very interesting, and I didn't expect, something I didn't necessarily expect to see. So that was a part of the day. When when it was over, when the service was over that day, after the procession with the cardinal and the mass, and a mass at which the cardinal, you know, went as far as someone in his position could go, when he called Caesar a special prophet for farm workers. That was high tribute from Cardinal Mahony, who did a great job and did a great homily that day. But the rest of the Native Americans, when he was taken out of the what we call the tent or the church, and going out there was another friend of mine, a fellow who lives in San Francisco, later related to me what he saw and asked me if I saw the same thing. But there was this great wind circle around Caesar's body as he was being put into the hearse there at the end. Anyway, that was just another very odd situation, the wind that came up on an otherwise not windy day as he was being put into the hearse. And the last part of that story is that 9 days later, after his passing, some Native Americans came by and stopped in La Paz and told whoever was there, they said, "We've just come from a sweat lodge up in Lone Pine, and we want to relate a story that the elder who was conducting the sweat lodge said to us, and to tell you, to come by here and leave the message that he had been in contact with the great leader who just died. And he wants everyone to know that he's doing well, but they need to let him go so he can complete his journey, where he can be more helpful to them than ever." So okay. That message, and they again spread more corn around his gravesite and did their smudge ceremony there as part of blessing his journey and letting people know to let him go on his journey who were holding on to him. So that was pretty fascinating, as was coming back to the burial. You know, there was a lot of problems with getting him buried in La Paz where he wanted to be buried, and we thought we were going to have him for a week or two at a funeral home in Tehachapi. But the next morning when we saw, or that night we saw the hole being dug, or the hole dug and the other things there, we knew that the permission was there, and the next morning we got to bury him there at La Paz, where he wanted to be buried with his dogs Boycott and Huelga, who were also buried there in that rose garden. And we had gotten special state authority and Catholic diocese authority to make that an official, that little plot of land, an official Catholic cemetery. But so there was a lot of that there with the symbolism around Native Americans, but the power of his relationship to thousands of people. And one thing I didn't do, I couldn't get to do, I think, but the one I couldn't do and the other I didn't do, and that was I had really wanted to take his body for a day to San Jose, which is where he spent a lot of his time, and it's the Bay Area where he's the most popular of anywhere in the country, and then to L.A. where he's very popular as well, to have him lie in state at those two places for a day. That I got overruled on. It didn't happen. And I had wanted to, like, take him by train down the Central Valley to do that. So I got overruled, and that didn't happen. But the other one what was the other that I didn't do? Around the burial. Gosh, I had it, and I lost my train of thought there on that one. But a lot of special moments around that. I remember what it was.
It was coming full circle, wasn't it, Richard?
Right, and when I remember one part of it is when after we buried him, Irving Nichols, who I said was the embalmer, came up to me and he says, we're talking near the gravesite as we finished burying Caesar, and he says, "You know, Richard, the bill for the two funeral homes, Anderson was $10,000, and House of Winston was $15,000. Cars, drivers from L.A. to, you know, Kern County, on and on and on." And he said, "I just talked to the two owners, both of whom were African-American women, and both of them didn't know Caesar, but both of them, in different conversations, told me, we didn't know him, but he was such a great inspiration. We can't charge that man's family any money."
Wow.
And so they forgave the debt right there as he was buried.
Wow.
They forgave the cost. And Irving got, you know, lived to be part of that funeral home still. So, but just a lot of things that took place around him going full circle.
Well, he touched so many people, Richard. I mean, he touched, and he continues to touch people. And I just wanted to, I know we're tiring you out, but I think we, you know, this interview that you just did with us was, is going to live on, you know, in for many, many years. And so I just wanted to thank you for doing it and for, you know, for allowing every, you know, it was easy to touch other people with your words. And so I just wanted to thank you very much for allowing me to do the interview with you. And I'm sure I speak for Leroy and the rest of the folks that we're very, very honored to be able to spend a couple hours with you.
Well, I'm the one who is honored, and, you know, I only wish there were several things that I probably forgot that I would have remembered and put in good form, but I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. And the other thing is, I'll tell you quite frankly, is any of those thoughts, if you could put them down in an article or an essay, because I did read your essay, the one you wrote, the one you sent me recently, that you sent to Cardinal Mahoney, you know, it was excellent, and I think, you know, there's many other ways on Leroy's website that, you know, that you could still spread, you could tell those other stories and spread the word.
Good, thank you. No, I really enjoyed it, Ray.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard, and thank you all the Niall and Marissa, Niall and Leroy and everybody else that's there. Thank you very, very much. And I'd like to just, you know, be in touch with you the next day or two to make sure that everything's good.